Are you surprised by it? Does it feel unexpected? Right? Like you have this like, wow, I hadn't thought of that before. And that emotion is important because it suggests that you've hit upon something that might not have been obvious, even if you have deep expertise in the topic, or even if you analyzed it to death. Like that, the surprise factor, by being surprising, is an indicator of success. I believe surprise is a leading indicator of innovation. And so we should look into those things when we try to figure out what to make of a click moment.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Hi, everyone. This is Tiffany Snyder from Digital to Learn, and I'm here with my co-host, Brad Garner. Welcome, Brad.
Hello, hello.
It's time for part two with Franz Johansson. This has been an amazing conversation so far, and we can't wait to keep the ball rolling. So without further ado, welcome back, Franz.
Thank you. It seems like as a team member operating in a Medici effect environment, I have to think to myself, I've got something to give, but I'm probably going to get back more than I can give from the other people that are in the group.
Yes, and the key here is that in that building and building on, a couple of things to remember, because when you're your own person, you're making the choices. Mm. When you're a team, the key is that what you're trying not to do is to compromise in your discussions with others. What you're trying to do is build something better, recombine. Mm. That's where some teams go wrong. They're like, well, let's just kind of like pick the mediocre middle.
Sounds about right.
Many examples of that.
Yeah, that's not what this is about. The second piece is that because of that, sometimes it means that your ideas are used, sometimes they're not, but they should always be valued. Mm. So the fact that something wasn't used as in a this sort of recombination at the intersection, all that means is that you are now setting yourself up for another test. And I'll give you an example of this play. I remember reading an article, maybe we're seeing at a conference, one of the designers at Apple, they said that for every new user feature on the iOS, this is at that time, so I don't know if this is still true, but for every new user feature, they create 10 separate teams to create 10 separate solutions. And they will pick one. Now ask yourself the question, who would join a team that has a built-in 90% failure rate? And the only person that would join a team like that is the team that is the person that knows that they will get another bite at the apple. Get it? But yeah, like you're
so good.
You get another bite at the apple, right? You can, well, if it doesn't work this time, I get another shot next time or another shot this time. So that's how these teams need to operate. It's about iteration, it's about trying, it's about trying many times. That's how that plays out.
Okay, good.
Well, you have another book that we want to talk about, The Click Moment. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, whereas The Medici Effect was a book that talked about a foundational theory of innovation, that diversity drives it, and has only increased and increased and increased in sort of scope and impact. With The Click Moment, I had to actually explore a second concept that I introduced in a Medici Effect, but I didn't know enough to settle. And that has to do with the question I would get is, well, what type of combinations are best? What type of intersections are powerful? And the answer to that is that we don't really know. It is effectively random. And that is why serendipity plays such a big part in innovation. I call it the click moment because if you look at almost every single company's trajectory, what we do after the fact is we create a narrative that makes it seem inevitable. It was the result of strategy and planning and brilliance and all of these. But then you start digging into it and you start realizing that, wait a minute, these places where the shift happened were really as much a result of serendipity and unexpected as anything else. YouTube started as a dating site. Okay. Most people have forgotten that at this point. The idea was you upload a video of yourself and then people vote whether or not I want to date you. which is a really bad idea.
Okay? Yes, that's what I'm thinking.
But then two of the founders went to dinner and they were sort of filming that dinner on a video camera, but they had nowhere to easily share that movie. They kind of realized that, maybe we could do that with our software. And they started seeing it pivot. Actually, from what I also heard, the third founder was trying to find a video of Janet Jackson's show at the 2004 Super Bowl where there was a wardrobe malfunction.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And then, well, what if there's a place where you can find that easily, right? Now, that became YouTube. Starbucks. Most people have forgotten that Starbucks started selling coffee beans and coffee makers. They did not sell coffee by the cup. And then Howard Schultz, who at that time was the director of retail operations, he goes to Milan in Italy, and he's on his way to a houseware conference. Why? Because to sell coffee makers, that's what you would do at a houseware conference. But then on his way to that conference, he walks by this place where there's a lot of people and they're talking. It's like, what is this place? And it turns out it's an espresso bar. Oh, it's an espresso. Howard Schultz, who's the future CEO in Starbucks, had at that point never tasted an espresso in his entire life. He'd never tested a latte in his entire life. He tastes this and he goes, oh my God, Starbucks has it all wrong. This is what we need to do. Click moments like this. Click, click, click. Those can be defining moments in our lives and in a company's journey. And I felt it was kind of weird that so little emphasis was placed on it and so much was placed on trying to do all the analysis and strategy work up front to try to figure out what the right path should be, but it doesn't actually look that way in real life.
Yeah.
So my guess would be that there have been historically and continue to be a lot of click moments that are just simply missed.
Yes, of course. How do we know when we are experiencing one of them? It's really difficult to do in the moment. It only sort of plays out in retrospect. And that's why click moments is really one of three in that book. In my book, The Click Moment, I outline the sort of the three different ways of harnessing serendipity, of harnessing randomness, right? So click moments is the first one. But the second one is around purposeful bets. And the third one has to do with capturing complex forces. But all three of them relate to the fact that we're not sure if something's going to work or not. So if you have a click moment, for instance, well, what do you do with that? Do you let it pass or do you decide to make a play of it? Well, you can't make a play of every single thing. So you need some guidance in that. And I talk a lot about how things that appeal to non-logical metrics are more relevant than those that do. The logical metrics, those things that sort of deeply play into that, are likely to be discovered by others as well, because there's a lot of logical people in the world. And they're themselves trying to sort through and figure out what's the next step. It's when it feels like it appeals to another emotion. It might be excitement. It might be curiosity. It might be passion. It might be discomfort. Discomfort is a positive indicator. And the most important one is, are you surprised by it? Does it feel unexpected? Not like you have this like, wow, I haven't thought of that before. And that emotion is important because it suggests that you've hit upon something that might not have been obvious, even if you have deep expertise in the topic, or even if you analyzed it to death. Like the surprise factor, by being surprising, is an indicator of success. I believe surprise is a leading indicator of innovation. And so we should look into those things when we try to figure out what to make of a click moment.
So it seems like the overarching theme that connects these two books, or two themes, I would think. One is always being in the posture of being a learner and also kind of reflecting all the time on what you're learning and how it connects.
The last piece you said there, I think, is the most important one. How do things connect? Like, you can lead an entire life being exposed to all kinds of different people, different ideas, different concepts. You're watching movies, reading books, you're traveling, not so much today, but when we do that again, all over the world, and none of it impacts you. You're just an observer. Oh, yeah, I love the Queen's Gambit on Netflix. Moving on. I was in Cleveland, and then I went to San Francisco, and then I went to Buenos Aires, and then I went, and I was a tourist, and I just observed. There's a party, lots of different people, and I'm a listener or I'm a talker. What the key is to connect. So you watch The Queen's Gambit. Huh. Is there a concept here? Mm-hmm. Is there an idea here that I can connect with what I'm working on right now? By the way, I love that show. And so this reflective moment now basically is, why did I like it? What was so different about it? Mm-hmm. And is there something I can learn from that? I traveled around the world. Okay, I'm in Melbourne, Australia, and am I just there as a visitor to give a speech, as a tourist, or is this something that I can pick up from how things are organized or structured or how people do things here and relate it back to what I'm doing? I mean, mm-hmm. So this connecting is the key. And that is true for both of these books. Because in The Meditative Vector, of course, I'm talking about connections. But in the second book, I'm saying that they're unexpected or surprising. And that means that by doing so repeatedly, you will have an unexpected connection by definition. And they are likely to be far more powerful than expected ones.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can help us solve a big problem today. Tiffany and I both work in higher education, mm-hmm. which we will readily admit is incredibly dysfunctional. Innovation does not seem to find its way into higher ed very often. What kind of advice would you give to folks in higher ed about becoming more responsive and innovative?
So I think that there is tremendous opportunity in higher ed. It's a big topic. It is one of my favorite topics. Let me just structure it up for a second.
Okay.
Higher ed can serve several purposes. Okay. One is maybe the stamp of approval purpose. And that comes from the legitimacy of an institution, for instance. I mean, so Oxford, from what I understand, haven't changed their teaching methodology in about 1,000 years. They have these small groups of students that sit with a professor and they talk things through. Why? Like, does that make any sense at all? Like, we've learned so much about how we talk about but for them, part of it is that, well, yeah, because if you've been educated at Oxford, it says something about who you are. It's a quality mark. And if we have to change that around too much, like Coca-Cola did with New Coke, they quickly went back to Classic Coke, because that will put in question the entire value of the education. The fact that it's succeeded for 1,000 years in and of itself is a stamp of approval. So there, it's almost like an institution actively trying to not innovate, because they're like stamp of approval. Okay, so let's put that in one little bucket of considerations that one has to sort of cope with. The second one is that the students of today, they need to be innovative. They need to make connections between fields and industries and cultures. They need to operate well under ambiguity. Mm. Our education system, all the way up through higher ed, it starts in first grade, where we try to remove all levels of the unexpected ambiguity. What is the obvious thing you do after you go through second grade? It's third grade, and everybody knows it. So we have this thing, right? It was very planned out, and it feeds, like, higher ed has been able to escape some of that. Of course, at this point, as a student, you're expected to do a certain amount of self-discovery. You're expected to do some of that yourself, which is great. But even within that, right, there is this battle between, well, what's the ROI of what I'm getting from education today and tomorrow? And how can you prepare me to be a contributor to society in other ways? So here's what I think needs to happen. I think that the entire edifice of higher education needs to be much more aligned towards making connections. That should happen in research. Mm-hmm. That should happen in teaching. It should be aligned towards being very comfortable with not giving the right or wrong answer. Yes. Okay. So if you're in engineering and you're trying to figure out if this load on a bridge works, yes. Okay. That's it. but should you build the bridge to begin with? I mean, that's another consideration. And higher ed is not really structured around that notion. And then the connections, the ambiguity piece, and this idea that we are driving action, analysis, for better or worse, it is becoming more important to move quickly than it is to overly analyze every single thing. Deep thought is important. We have to learn how to do it. But we simply have to be able to find ways and methods to do it faster and quicker. Mm-hmm. This is the reality. Nokia would spend 6 months, when a new technology came out, they would spend 6 months analyzing the value of that technology for their company. It made sense in the 90s. Today, if you're spending 6 months analyzing the value of a new technology for your company, the game is over.
Yeah.
By the time you arrive.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think not only that, the method, I mean, it took COVID to really push higher ed to start thinking about different delivery methods.
That's true.
I think when COVID is over, we will find a different landscape. It does not mean that there's not great value to be in person. Of course it is. But I believe the future is hybrid. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be hybrid in organizations. It's going to be hybrid in ed. It's going to be hybrid in life.
Yep.
We will see people more comfortable today being in relationships that are virtual because we've been taught how to do some of that. It's not the same, but it's not like it's zero either.
Our team has been working remotely for the last 8 months, and we have commented several times how this kind of break from being in the office has made us incredibly more creative and more productive. And at the same time, still connected with one another.
Isn't that amazing? And your discovery around this is not in isolation. You find this everywhere. Before March 15th, right? Well, companies and organizations and universities, et cetera, would hire consulting firms for expensive studies. Is it possible to work virtually?
Yes.
And then like in a week.
Yes,
it is. And the surprising fact is, we thought that maybe 20% of the things that we did could be done virtually. It turns out that 80% of the stuff that we do can be done virtually. There's some things that we're still missing out on, but they're far fewer and much less of an impact than we expected.
Absolutely. So final question for you. I'm guessing there's another book rolling around in that head of yours.
No, he's already doing 2 hours every evening. 2 hours of writing every evening, right?
Yeah.
What are you working on now?
I was just did an event earlier this week, and I got this question from somebody who's like, when is it coming? What is going on? So yes, it's been an exceptionally busy time building this company that I have. Around this product renaissance, it is a revolutionary platform, and we're growing it very, very quickly. It's high growth. So, all of the energies and efforts have gone into that. I do know what I want this third book to be about, and so my hope is that I'll be able to turn my attention towards it again next year once we've been able to make a significant number of hires. You know, they need to be a significant contribution, I believe, to how we think and how we act. You know, I don't necessarily feel a compulsion to come out with a new book every 2 or 3 years or more often. You know, you see that with some authors. And of course, because that's what they do. I'm looking at a multimodal way basically to impact the world. And so this third book is going to be a significant contribution. To do that, it requires that type of effort and time.
Well, consider this an invitation to come back and be with us again when that book is finished. We can't wait to talk about it.
You're on.
Yeah.
Awesome.
This has been a thrill ride. I mean, just your ideas and conversation. We thank you so much for being with us today.
And I thank you. This was a terrific conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are 3 things we ask you to do. 1, come back and join us again. 2, tell your friends about us. And 3, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.